And why? And why doesn't it work? Do you remember when Haiti had that earthquake? You probably don't, you self-centred swine. And if you do, I bet it's because of the star-spangled telethon that came in its wake. The telethon is a near-permanent fixture in our culture and, in a way, the perfect concoction for a society that wants to release hot little farts of compassion but without wanting to ever actually follow through. I've done a fair bit of that stuff, like comic relief in the UK, and I was invited to participate in this grotesquely beautiful effort to provide aid for the victims of the 2010 disaster by George Clooney, and was instantly told by someone at the agency that attendance was mandatory as it was a good career opportunity, which I'm sure, as much as the rice and antibiotics, soothed the displaced Haitians. I'm sorry you lost your house and leg and dog and daughter. Here's some medicine that was purchased in the most glamorous way imaginable in a format that's given some Hollywood newcomers a real chance to shine. The reason this event was spectacular in the crowded marketplace of television benefits was because of the sheer density of stars. It was obscene, like fame porn. As I nervously shuttled through security like a first-day intern into the CBS studios, I was so overwhelmed by the frequency of famous faces in an enclosed space that I almost exploded. If I had have done, it would have dramatically reconfigured the firmament of popular entertainment and been so newsworthy that it would have dwarfed the earthquake we were nominally there to redress. What is this tenuous equation between fame and tragedy? What celestial matchmaker has slung together these mismatched phenomena? Fame to treat famine, fame to treat poverty, fame to take the boredom away, an implausible coupling that advances the benefactor more than the beneficiary, a panacea for a sickness that we feed as we claim to treat it, a snake oil cure for a reptilian nation. Still, I went anyway. As I say, it was a good opportunity. I'm glad I went too. It was like Madame Tussauds after a visit from a wizard. I was instructed that under no circumstances was I to be late. This was a compassion party for the glitterati and lateness was not an option. At no point in the administrative process that preceded my attendance was there a whiff, hint or mention of the people of Haiti. It appalls me to confess that I don't recall having any actual connection with the reality of the situation, that a natural disaster had sent a nation spiralling into chaos, disarray and tragedy. In my head, it was kind of like I was a last-minute replacement for the best man at George Clooney's wedding and had to get to the venue on time at all costs, which sounds a bit like the plot of a film we'd be in. I'm not pointing the finger at anyone else, by the way. They may all have been there with the noblest intent. I can't imagine Robert De Niro was there to hobnob and network. I'm prepared to accept sole responsibility for this hollowness and duplicity. Perhaps it was just me that had no visceral human connection to the suffering. Actually, though, isn't that what these telethons are for? Not to actualise the disaster, to make it real, feel it, process it and resolve it, but to remove it, package it, give it a framework that is manageable somehow. Yes, the tectonic plates are colliding and humanity is tumbling into the magma at the Earth's core, but don't worry, we've got Leonardo DiCaprio on line one. If you're lucky, you get Leo or De Niro or Pacino or Daniel Day-Lewis or J-Lo or Brangelina. In one little sweep of my eye across a distance of about 12 yards, I was able to assemble the above constellation in some ghoulish, grafted menagerie of fame, the lot of them stacked up into phone banks like really well-groomed battery hens. It made me feel a bit sick and nervous and then laugh and do a bit of wee. But the density of stars, too many to be a constellation. In such numbers, they become more gas than solid, like the nebula of collapsing gas that incites the stellar inception, like an episode of Celebrity Squares held at Diana's funeral. Too much, just too much, and as William Blake has always said, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. The wisdom reached by excess of this nature is that it's all fucking bollocks, the celebrity equivalent of making a kid you catch smoking a fag do the whole packet. So it's fame you like, is it? Well, how about all the famous people in the world jammed into one chilled, airless glass box? Not everyone who called in by phone to pledge their donation was lucky enough to get George or Jack or Al. Some of them got me. And after about the third person had indignantly inquired, who? And I had tired of explaining Sarah Marshall and Saxgate, I just started saying, yeah, it's Spider-Man here. How can I help you? And hoping that Tobey Maguire couldn't hear me. In my haste to arrive on time for this glistening festival of opulent first aid, me and my mates had driven like loonies the wrong way up the hard shoulder of a freeway. It's the only time I've ever felt free on one. I know George Clooney is probably a decent geezer and all that, and I'm no more condemning him for the vacuity of celebrity-driven humanitarianism than I am David Cameron for capitalism. I'm just saying, how long can you inhabit this sparkling candy palace without wanting to kick down the walls? If you're not on the inside trying to get out, are you outside trying to get in, or are you indifferent to the whole charade? Were you never taken in? Under what circumstances is continuing to live like this the best option? Only if you have no belief that any alternative is possible. Only then. The celebrities feel better for taking part, the callers feel better for donating, the Haitians get a bit of aid that they should rightly have been given under the covenant of brotherhood that exists between us all, and we all just smile and pretend there's no alternative. There is another way. There is the way. To live in accordance with truth, to accept we are on a planet that has resources and people on it. We have to respect the planet so we can use the resources to nourish the people. Somehow this simple equation has been allowed to become extremely confusing. If I, so close to the peak, could glean no joy from that rarefied air, the air I was told as soon as I'd acquired language would absolve me, if in fact all I gleaned was the view from that peak, the vista true, that the whole climb had been a spellbound clamber up an edifice of foolishness, then what possible salvation can there be for those at the foothills or dying on the slopes, or those for whom the climb is not even an option? What is their solution? Well, it's the same solution that's available to me. The only solution that will make any of us free, to detach the harness and fall within. Now that's what I call an extended metaphor. In Fairfield, Iowa, then, there could be the solution. But none of us want a boring solution. The revolution cannot be boring. Chapter 14. Get money out of politics. Do we, as human beings alive now, us, the sum total of humanity, I assume everyone is reading this book, do we have a vision, a shared vision, towards which we can move in synchronicity? As a man in recovery, I must remain in serenity, clean and serene. I've spent enough time jazzed, wired, buzzing and gouching. Serenity is the first thing people with addiction issues are instructed to request. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's what junkies and alkies and bulimics and gamblers and sex addicts and love addicts and the people who can't stop shopping, smoking, loving, fighting, whatever it is, there's someone out there who's doing too much of it. And for those people, there's a solution and sanctuary. And in those places of sanctuary, this prayer is recited. The first thing is serenity. The agitation has to end. The itchy irritability, the restlessness, the wanting. So do the lows, the self-loathing, wretched, heavy-hearted, lead-gutted, teary-eyed, dry-mouthed misery, the pain. So do the highs, the wide-eyed, bilious highs, the cheek-chewing, trouble-brewing highs, the never-stopping-till-I-touch-the-sky highs, the up-at-dawn, hitting-the-pipe highs, chasing, defacing, hot-racing highs, gagging, shagging, blagging highs. All the things we do to change the way we feel, the way the world looks and tastes, it's all gotta go. So courage is necessary. Courage to change yourself, the one thing you can change, your attitude and actions. Neither the serenity nor the courage are available to you on your own. If they were, you would have found them by now. You've been pretty fastidious in your research. God, however you conceptualize him, will have to grant them to you. And whatever you conceptualize God as with your human mind, your individual brain made up of instinctive responses, training and memories, however you conceptualize a power that's beyond you and the decisions you've made so far, your conception will be extremely limited, likely as limited as my cat's conception of the internet. The invisible network of interconnected portals that communicate data are beyond my cat's comprehension. My cat's inability to comprehend does not impede the internet. The World Wide Web, which is incidentally quicker to say than www. will continue to exist regardless of my cat's awareness. Pray then for wisdom. Wisdom to know the difference between things we can change and things we can't. Likely this will be a lifetime's work undertaken one day at a time, which for humans is the way time happens. I don't have to live in the 25th of May 2022 yet. I might never have to. I only have to live in this moment. That's why meditation comes in handy, and practicing it as a community has benefits too. How are we to achieve real change, conditions in which practices that lead to a different type of consciousness can plausibly be pursued? I spoke to my friend Dave DeGraw, a seasoned and, let's say, grizzled activist and member of the Occupy movement. Dave knows loads about global politics, protest, economics and so on, and uses words like metrics and paradigm. He also speaks a bit like a beatnik and seems forever on the verge of using antiquated Kerouacian slang like "cool it, daddy-o." I wrote to him electronically and asked him how to change the world. If you're expecting political legislation to solve any of our problems, you're barking up the wrong dead old tree. No matter what issue you care about most, no real lasting change will come from a rigged and corrupt system. I'd say his opening gambit there is a pretty good example of what I was saying. Dead old tree sounds like the way that Allen Ginsberg would describe a Republican's penis. Dave's first observation is that to bring about real change, we have to act outside the current political system, which chimes with what Naomi Klein said about advance on environmental issues. Real change will not be delivered within the machinery of the current system. It's against their interests. Unless we get money out of politics, campaign finance, lobbying, and the revolving door between governments and the most powerful global corporations, we are not going to create change within these old, obsolete, and decaying governmental systems. Princeton University recently did a study revealing what those of us paying attention already know all too well. The United States is, in specifically proven fact, not a democracy. They concluded that the US is controlled by economic elites. This is a prominent idea that is becoming popular. The structural reason that voting is redundant is that through the funding of political parties, lobbying and cronyism, corporations are able to ensure that their interests are prioritised above the needs of the electorate and that ideas that contravene their agenda don't even make it into the sphere of public debate. Whoever you vote for, you'll be voting for a party that represents a big business agenda, not the will of the people. Here in the US, and in many countries around the world, these governments were created in a bygone era, in the time of the horse and wagon. It took days to get one handwritten message across state lines. You needed representatives for the government to function. Now here we are, in 2014, with instantaneous worldwide communication. Now we have access to unlimited information. A kid with a cell phone has access to more information than the President of the United States had only 25 years ago. 25 years ago, the president was Ronald Reagan. It's probably for the best. He didn't seem like he'd be that at ease with technology. I was quite anxious that he had the power to launch nuclear missiles, and rightly so, as we now know he was already suffering from dementia. It says a lot for our expectations of politicians that no one really noticed. Back to Dave. The need to have a handful of representatives deciding our collective fate, or just have two or three dominant political parties in this age of mass communication, is a sick and perverted joke. Dave's getting into his stride now. He's really moving into beatnik mode. He's probably on the precipice of taking a mighty puff on his doobie and giving the bongos a real wallop. Once every 2, 4, or 6 years, we get to vote for Puppet A or Puppet B. Oh, please. Thomas Jefferson was an enlightened cat. He had a lot of brilliantly insightful riffs. Yep, thought so. He's called revered statesman Thomas Jefferson Tommy, referred to him as an enlightened cat, and called his oratorical pronouncements riffs. I bet he wrote this with no shoes and socks on, wearing them little round John Lennon sunglasses. He continues with a Jefferson quote. Every generation needs a new revolution. He said that over 200 years ago, not one revolution in this nation since then. It's good to know that a respectable, bewigged statesman like Jefferson knew that to prevent an incremental drift towards hegemony and corruption, each generation would need to reassert a demand for fairness. One of the ways the current power structures are protected is through tradition. Dave continues, "You can't meddle with the Constitution, the economy, the monarchy. It's one of our proudest traditions." A tradition is just an old idea. Only of value if it remains relevant. To remain relevant, it must resonate with timeless principles, principles of unity and fairness. These institutions and statutes are riddled with language that fetishize unity and oneness, one nation under God, the monarch's duty to preserve peace. When it comes to crunch time, the only time that's real, the only maxim these ideas protect is elitist and hegemonic. Dave DeGraw is right. Traditions that do not help us are as valuable as excess fingernail and should be dispensed with in the same manner. I deplore those long, brown, curly fingernail folk. I don't even especially like people who have one long thumbnail for guitar. My mate Carl has one, and it scratched me the other day. I was sickened. Chapter 15. Spectacular. How can modern technology aid democracy? Dave DeGraw continues. From a technological standpoint, we are ready for liquid democracy. With liquid democracy, you can designate your vote on any issue to any person of your choice. For example, if there's an economic policy that is coming up for a vote, but you don't understand the policy that well, you can give your vote to someone you trust who does understand the policy. With the level of technology that we now have, that's a common sense, sensible political system that would provide a vibrant democracy and legitimately reflect the will of the people. Liquid democracy, then. A form of direct, electronic, participatory democracy that acknowledges that a lot of people won't vote on a tedious issue like planning permission for a new sewage system, which inadvertently implies that the liquid in this liquid democracy is fecal. Nonetheless, in a devolved, collectivised, participatory democracy, a small, self-determined constituency can nominate an accountable figure to act on their behalf. As we've said before in relation to Dave Graeber's input, democracy would be good. Democracy ain't what we've got. An empowered, involved, civil society who see their collective will delivered is now a possibility. Adam Curtis, the filmmaker, has insisted with a tenacity and fervour that truly only belongs in cage fighting that I point out that social media like Facebook and Twitter are of no use when it comes to bringing about radical change. He regards these arrivist communicative tools as useful only for clicktivism and loose social ties, not the ardent bonds required to get people to risk their lives confronting authority. I think that as new ideologies are nurtured and deployed, new social tools like those mentioned will be as useful as anything else in connecting people and conveying information. As long as Facebook don't, at the behest of the FBI, stick up a load of moody info designed to put you on a massive downer. Switzerland are already cracking on with direct democracy, with results which are impeded, I think, by the context in which they occur. Switzerland. Have you ever been there? It's peaceful, it's clean, the chocolate is delicious, but the Swiss people are dependent upon the same sources of information that everywhere else is, so their state of limited electronic referenda reflects that. Anyone can get a bill voted on if they get 50,000 signatures. Some interesting referenda have been held. 1. Basic income. Give everyone a basic income of 20 grand a year and get rid of all forms of welfare. Welfare carries stigmatisation. This policy could address that. They voted against it. Maximum wage. CEOs of companies, head honchos and big cheeses are earning too much money. In America, your average CEO, if you can conceive of such a being, earns 350 times the average worker's salary. There should be a cap for top earners, either a ratio, like 10 times the lowest paid member of the workforce, or a figure, say 500,000 euros, pounds or dollars. The Swiss held a referendum. They voted against it. 3. Restrictions on the construction of new places of worship, like mosques. A lot of people, as you know from the media, are worried about the type of vocal and visual symbols people use when envisaging supreme energy fields from which all other energy fields are derived. The Swiss held a referendum on whether to ban the building of mosques. They voted for it. Now, I am not about to claim as we approach the midpoint of this book to be a social scientist. There is too much dependence on anecdotal evidence, too much faith in the mystical, and too much radicalism for that. Plus, zero education in that field. You almost certainly require A-levels. Fuck that. My point is that the outcome of these referenda are suspiciously concordant with the will of the elites that typically exert their power through more easily manipulated dual-party democracy. Why is that, Dave? The first step toward evolution and freedom is to get a conscious understanding of the mental prison that we are all bred into. Our consciousness is conditioned from cradle to grave. As the ghost of Goethe whispers in the wind, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. What the results of direct democracy in Switzerland indicate is that even measures that seem to put power directly into the hands of people are redundant if we are not given access to reliable information. We need a media that isn't governed by the same ideology as the big businesses for whom our governments administrate. Dave uses this illustrative Guy Debord quote to help us understand the information we are fed through the media and the function of that information. For what is communicated are orders. Those who give them are also those who tell us what they think of them. De Boer, who is a clever old stick and as French as adultery, was a situationist. This was a gang of avant-garde artists, political theorists and smart asses who thought that Marxism was basically all right, but a bit too strict, what with the gulags and murders and bullying. That, though, didn't detract from the irrefutable fact that capitalism, in spite of providing us with lovely tellies and apparently enhanced standard of living, was eroding the essential experience of being human. They thought that it led to social alienation, us lot feeling all lonely, detached from each other, our environment and our own nature, plus commodity fetishisation. I like the word fetish. You've probably noticed I keep using it. Fetish was originally used to describe an object of religious devotion, like a relic sold by an archaeologist trickster. There's the St. Bernadette's finger. It's yours for a fiver. You could then stare at the dubious digit and think a bunch of holy stuff, the object providing a visual focus for devotional mental activity. These days, when we hear the word, when I first heard the word, it was in regard to sexual fetish. Frank's got a foot fetish, you might hear. This is where poor old Frank has got himself into such a palaver about how's your father that he can no longer express himself through straightforward coital activity, which due to his childhood or whatever, he regards as a dumb mechanical thrust of flesh pistons and clutching mucus-covered valves. His only way back to enjoyment of erotic activity is via a manageable deviation from the pure source, like a lovely well-pedicured tootsie with violet lacquered nails like his Auntie Val used to have when she rocked him on her lap and he felt free from the clammy tyranny of Mummy's arms and the clattering exasperation of Daddy's tobacconated sigh. That's Frank for you, the poor bugger. Commodity fetishism is the application of fulfilment to an object that can be acquired through the market. We know, don't we, in our little hearts, in our clearer, truer selves, that a Ferrari, while superficially geometrically pleasing and aesthetically titillating with its curves and pulsating scarlet haunches, is just a bloody dumb lump of potential travel. A swift little electronic cart. We know, don't we, in the place in our hearts where we felt connected to our first friend or first noticed that the grass in the garden was beautiful to touch or smell, that a pair of calf-high, Cuban-heeled, pointy-toed, zip-up black Dior boots are just clods to plod the pavement with. We know, don't we, do we, Russell, that they cannot, will not, shall not give us relief or sanctuary or love. Do we really want to end our lives without discarding these lies? Do we want to hunker down into our earthly cradle, never having released from the grip of the anxious mind the ridiculous lie that material things can provide solutions instead of the sublime? Do you want those boots if the true cost is God, if the true cost is family, if the true cost is that most American of dreams, freedom? Well, Guy Debord and his clever clog chums thought it had to go. They cooked up this idea called the spectacle to help us understand what was going on, a philosophical tool that provided a story to deliver to our pickled brains the troubling truth that we are now experiencing a second-hand, approximate reality. They demonstrated this by creating situations that exposed the absurdity of our reality, the unquestioned reality which we all accept. The movement was inherently political and people still use it to make a point, like by nicking some valuable paintings from a museum and using them on barricades in a neighbourhood where there's a lot of argy-bargy, to demonstrate that the authorities, when reclaiming the artworks, are more concerned about the preservation of heirlooms than people. Dom Jolly, Sacha Baron Cohen and Jackass, in a way, do stuff derived from this tradition because their crazy public antics make us question the nature of customary, consensual behaviour. Mostly for a laugh, though. At its inception, situationism was politically motivated. These ideas were influential in the uprisings that took place all over the world in the 60s, particularly in Paris. As you know, the French are never truly happy unless chopping someone's head off or having it off with someone else's missus. I suppose the perfect scenario would be to have some petrified aristo genuflecting at the altar of the guillotine god while just out of sight, Jacques or whatever, carries on with his wife. But let's not get bogged down in senseless xenophobia. The point is that fetishism, whether religious, sexual or commercial, is a diversion from the source. This idea is not dissimilar to Radhanath Swami's observation that all desire is the inappropriate substitute for the desire to be at one with God. or to live in harmony with the whole, in union with the truth. The truth. The truth is, there are on this frequency, from our human perspective, a planet, some beings, some resources. Would it not be sensible to employ systems that benefit the planet, the beings, and the resources? Not needlessly revere artificial constructs that only benefit a few people. Dave now, the beatnik rabble-rouser that he is, explains some of the economic dimensions to our current absurd situation. Distribution and profits are at an all-time high. Instead of this dramatic increase in wealth creation delivering a healthier standard of living to everyone, it has been consolidated within a mere fraction of the global population. In the United States, 95% of income gains since the recession began have gone to the top 0.01%. Phew, I'm glad to find a statistic about extreme wealth that doesn't include me. As you know, one of the techniques to negate the ideas in this book, or the stuff I say, is to harp on about the fact that I've made a load of wedge. Well, I'm not in that problematic percentile, so that's good. Also, I'm not averse to giving up wealth in circumstances determined by the collective will. To contra-paraphrase New Labour architect and vandal of British socialism, Peter Mandelson, I'm seriously comfortable with society getting extremely equal. Now, let's give Dave back the cudgel to browbeat us into supplicant acceptance of his version of contemporary finances. In the US, the 400 richest people have as much as 185 million people, over 60% of the population. As absurd as that is, on a global scale, the richest 85 people have as much as 3.5 billion people, half of humanity. We are well aware of the fund bust statistic, but it's nice to hear it from a variety of sources. It's the sort of information that ought to be more prominent, promoted ahead of Kim and Kanye, or even football. The more we think about that statistic, the more likely that we'll be moved to act on the peaceful establishment of a fair global alternative, some of the tenets of which are becoming apparent to us. Self-governance, decentralisation of power, cancellation of unfair debt, removal of corrupt global trade agreements, a return to local responsible agriculture, and the removal of the physical and psychological tools of the powerful, and portraits of me in every living room. I added the last one for a laugh. Dave reckons, a bit like the economist Thomas Piketty, French of course, that this is not a glitch, a blip, or a hiccup. This is the intended result of our economic system. This is not happening by mistake or inevitability. During the bailout of Wall Street, $30 trillion in support and subsidies went to the most powerful players on Wall Street. That was the greatest theft of wealth in history. Throughout the entire world, the Federal Reserve, IMF, World Bank, ECB and BIS carry out genocidal economic policies. Just because that sounds hyperbolic and incredibly harsh doesn't mean it's not true. I don't recognise a lot of those acronyms. I know IMF, International Monetary Fund, but ECB and BIS are a mystery to me. Russell, you could Google them in the time it took to say this sentence. No, I couldn't. I turn the internet off when I do this, otherwise I get distracted looking at pointless balderdash trying to claim its research. Furthermore, it's bloody obvious that they're international financial institutions that were set up to deregulate trade conditions for global conglomerates and make it easier for marauding corporations to subjugate the rest of us into weary compliance. Look it up yourself or ask a grown-up. I've got to say 100,000 words here, and also that at the end of it I get a 10-second warm, consolatory glow. Oh, I've got shit GCSEs, but look, I've done a book. Then a bunch of cunts telling me I'm a hypocrite. Then probably someone will go through this book with a fine-tooth comb, find an example of me being a bit sexist or something, and try and dismiss the broader argument. You look it up. We're all in this together and trying to get past the old ideas of exalted individuals solving problems. Here's some more terrifying jargon from Dave. In the last year, the Federal Reserve handed out another $1 trillion through their quantitative easing, QE, program. Most all of that money, like the trillions during the bailout, went to the big six banks so they could dish out all-time record-breaking bonuses. Let's break this one minor Fed program down. With the $1 trillion they most recently handed out, you can give every unemployed person in America a $50,000 per year job. Quantitative easing is a typically euphemistic piece of imperialistic lingo. It does, however, have the advantage of poetically inferring the application of a lubricant before a shafting. Dave DeGraw here, like his Occupy cohort Dave Graeber, points out that resources are present here in the abstract, symbolic form of dollars. This is a concept that refers to assumed wealth. Graeber said we could cancel the debts of everyone instead of an elite. De Grauw says we could use the money to create employment for loads of people and ease life for ordinary people, not just an elite. Both demonstrate that the system, its language, ideologies and practices are volitional, not absolute. We're not discussing gravity here, a seemingly irrefutable law. It's just an idea that works well for the people who say it's the only idea there is. Like gravity for elites. If it was up to them, the rest of us would be floating around or paying through the nose for lead booties. This is not a worthy humanitarian argument to aid the destitute. Normal people, literally almost everyone, is getting fucked. Dave continues. As bad as unemployment is, even among workers, almost half of the working population earns less today than people making minimum wage did in 1968. A stunning 76% of the US population is living paycheck to paycheck, whilst US millionaires have $50 trillion in wealth, an all-time record number of people are toiling in poverty, hunger, prison and severe debt. When you fully grasp the situation, you realise that this is the greatest crime against humanity in the history of civilization. It's important to note that this is not a problem for radicals or lefties or hippies. If you are a person who breathes air and are not reading this on a bejeweled bus with 84 other plutocrats, then this corrosive, outmoded doctrine is affecting you. Even if you are a billionaire, a multi-billionaire, if you are Roman Abramovich or a Hinduja or Dick Cheney or George W. Bush, only joking, he wouldn't read a book, ha 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 ha, you are of course part of the whole of humanity, about to realise that individualism was an old, primitive idea, that materialism is a bric-a-brac concept for toddler brains, that we are at a moment of history where consciousness is going to coalesce, collectivise, return to the whole, where the business of being human is going to become something wonderfully unrecognisable, so we must relegate the mundane to its rightful place. The practical, fair allocation of resources, the preservation of the planet must naturally be prioritised so we can all get on with the exciting stuff, communing in unknown realms, summoning new ideas into our reality. The answers are all around us, cluttering up the culture like a magical amulet ignored in a junk shop. Chapter 16. On Earth as it is in Heaven. If you grew up in a secular but previously Christian culture like I did, then these ideas were blandly recited in assembly, draped in antiquated code like a verbal doily, making it seem like some tiresome old crud at a fate. The Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven. The first word is our. We have a shared provenance. We come from the same place. We have one Father. Clearly not biologically, but they didn't have words like biology then. I wonder what words we lack now. What labelless realms evade us for want of a consensual symbol. Right. So we all come from the same entity, or Father. Now, where is this guy? He's in heaven. Is that a place in the clouds, a place of silent reflection within all of us, a gay nightclub on Charing Cross Road in the 90s? The answer is yes to all three, but more importantly, it implies a realm or dimension that is not here, not knowable, but from where we, as children of this Father, emanate. Perhaps a subtler, electromagnetic realm beyond our understanding, from which all tangible phenomena is emitted. In Sanskrit, all characters are connected by a single line. The individual letters, words, sentences, concepts, therefore, demonstrably have the same genesis. They all come from the pure line, the total unimpeded form. In the beginning there was the Word, is how a very popular, relatively recent book commences. All came from the vibration of unrealized infinite possibilities. Tap any physicist you like on the shoulder and they'll tell you that we are made of stardust, that the component elements of everything on our planet and in our bodies are made of nitrogen, hydrogen, and carbon dioxide. So is the sun. so are all the stars. In there, give us one miracle and we'll describe the rest version of events. There was a big bang or a giant vibration or a sound or a word. Then all things came into being. This, to me, still sounds divine. So, we all came from one place, an unknown dimension that is loving, or at least benevolent, like a father. Now, there's a bit of patriarchy thrown in there to subjugate the evident superior power of feminine creative energy. Anything that gives birth to something by our understanding is feminine, but let's give the people who wrote the prayer a break. They were probably men, and they were following orders. Also, at some point, it'll be nice to get beyond dualistic concepts like masculine and feminine, because they're a bit old-fashioned. The prayer, or thought code, continues. Hallowed be thy name. Hallowed is a word that really hasn't made the cut into the contemporary lexicon. It's probably the most antiquated word in the prayer. Who ever says hallowed now? No one. It might be in the title of a Harry Potter film. Is it definitely hallowed? Is that one of them? I don't know. Either way, it just means worthy of reverence and a bit hard to grasp by the individualistic, repressed, unevolved, sense-bound consciousness. It's special and pure, fine. Even the name of this Father, in heaven, is radiant with some magical, ethereal, tricky-to-comprehend quality. Got it. Thy kingdom come. This realm, where the creative force is, where we came from, that's all hallowed, is coming here. Bloody hell, look alive, God's on his way. It might be an incantation, like we're inviting this realm to be realised in us, through our bound consciousness, so don't panic. Thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. Yes, it was that, an incantation. Don't worry, God's not on his way in a fiery chariot of judgmental rage. We can manifest God, this divinity, this creative vibration, here in this dimension and make it correlate with its subtler, original frequency. We can download it. Really, all that means is stop fucking about with things that don't have meaning, like money, Dior boots and blowjobs, because it's stupid and detached from original intention. Not bad, just compartmentalised. Do it if you want, you have free will, but if your intention is contentment, you're wasting your time with all that. Give us this day our daily bread. So we do need food. I mean, we have bodies. So some bread would be nice, or pasta, or veg, anything really. I'm not fussy, but I will need some grub at some point. Interesting that it is us, all of us. We are a community of people and we would like some bread. It's not give me some bread and fuck the immigrants. We ask on behalf of everyone. Also, we only need the bread today, in the moment, in the present. The future and the past are only relevant to the limited, animalistic, reductive view of reality that we indulge in to our detriment. We don't need 10 years worth of bread either, in case. Just our daily bread will do. And forgive us our trespasses. We will fuck up. We're just people, expressions of a higher consciousness permutated through a physical dimension. I mean, we need bread and everything. We're flawed. Please be compassionate to us. Divine creative power within us. Without us. It reiterates us. As we forgive those who trespass against us. Ah, so there are conditions. We've got to be forgiving too. It's not a one-way street, this compassion. It's not perfect. We ourselves will have to let go of our perceived transgressions or trespasses, which I saw in incredibly literal terms as a kid and thought referred to scrumping or hijinks. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. This is a bit confusing. After everything that's preceded it, after all this righteousness, why would him leading us into temptation be likely? Perhaps it's at this point that we acknowledge that it is not an external, abstract entity that we are addressing, but our own nature. In the past, I thought it a bit simplistic to consider hunger, lust, and aggression as inferior to grace, love, and service. By what barometer can we begin to measure? If all these qualities exist in our nature, how can we divide them up and apply tags like good and bad to them? Aleister Crowley and all the pagan devil-worshipping types extol a far less challenging "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law" philosophy. I gave it a whirl, hedonism, indulgence, animalism, and I believe there is an essential difference. Those impulses, when acted upon, create competitive and destructive conditions. Personally, too, I found that those impulses were deviations from the source. Often I'd think, I must have some heroin, or oh, I'd love an orgy. Then I'd act on that and be surprised by the lack of fulfilment. I believe natural instincts go awry. What was I really seeking when scoring and using heroin? Heroin is an opiate. Opiates are painkillers. I was in spiritual pain. I have come to believe that the reason I was using drugs was to treat a spiritual malady. A flailing, disconnected tendril searching for connection and failing to find it. I had to be sedated. When I began my life in abstinence-based recovery, living one day at a time without the use of drugs and alcohol, the impulse that drove me to seek out oblivion remained. I believe it is the impulse for union that is denied by our atomized and secular culture. The flailing tendril then took on a somewhat obvious and visually apposite course of action to fulfill this longing for connection. It's kind of transparent. The symptoms of addiction are like the behaviours of caged, pacing animals, a response to an unnatural condition. Does it sound a bit phony when I say that in my grand prix of priapic glee I was actually seeking salvation? Does that sound like something you might hear in a Southern Baptist church or a South London gospel gathering, or worse, a treatment centre for sexual addiction? My research in this area has been quite thorough, and I'd say my findings are quite conclusive. I've engaged in scenarios that from the outside, looking in when I was an adolescent in Essex, would have been indistinguishable from Eden. Looking at a papped shot of myself emerging from a London nightclub at 2 a.m. with a blonde on each arm and shades on, I can still be deceived into thinking, wow, I'd like to be him. Then I remember that I was him. Brought up on Frank McAvenny and Benny Hill and Carry on the telly, it's easy to understand how a mental plan is formed. I can't unsee the truth behind that photograph, the reality behind the veil. That night with the two immaculate girls delivered from Babe Station via some club in Hanover Square did not feel like it looked. Legal asterisk. They weren't delivered. They came of their own volition. I just like the poetics of delivered. It sounds better. Those women aren't a corporate entity worthy of fearing. Neither is Babe Station. Silly business all round this. When I got back home to the house that I dutifully purchased and done up like a space-age Byron would have, flock black wallpaper, shag pile carpets, jacuzzi, the jacuzzi, lowered in the garden by a crane that gurgled like an oracle in my garden, murkier with each new sacrifice. A TV in every room, a yoga studio with a wipe clean floor, but unless you do the yoga, you won't get a wipe clean mind. The girls come in and drink wine. I don't drink wine, so I don't spill wine, but they do. The humanity will not be silenced as we kiss. Nagging angels burden me with their invitations. Glasses get broken like promises I was given, given then and given when I took these ideas on board. Kisses are exchanged and lips get derivatively bitten, and I am unsmitten and unforgiven, and when they leave I sit broken and longing on the chaise. The glass window above the door says number one, Gardner Road. It casts a shadow from a street lamp, and on the wall it looks like no one, as my mate Matt observed, and I am alone but for the cat. Even though when it works after I rip it up in front of 3,000 at the Brixton Academy and I head back with a netball team from Essex, all phase and traces refracted from greys and faces, after the mandatory jacuzzi I look up at them from the quilted mortuary slab of my chamber as they pick over me like thwarted but amused surgeons. I watch them through anaesthesia and pray amnesia will help me forget what I'm doomed to regret. Like perfumed and glossed vultures, they peck my carcass, and a petit mort is insufficient. I am like Frankenstein here, assembled from boneyard parts. Other people's limbs and thoughts stitched together and jerked to life. Why is this not working? Was Sam Fox lying? Is Hugh Hefner lying? Is everybody lying? They look like broken toys to me, like an unlicensed Pitsy Market ET whose finger don't light up, given to me, sat on my knee. I don't want to be led back to that. I want to be delivered from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory for ever and ever. Amen. Chapter 17. War. What is it good for? Capitalism, obviously.
If you can transcend the limits of the instinctual and anatomical self, you can become part of a kingdom of unified consciousness defined by power, glory, and eternity. This is a journey I have made, but enlightenment is not like a summit that can be scaled then perched atop of like a jolly mountaineer with rosy cheeks eating a pork pie. It is a commitment to live in the moment. When I consider myself to be a member of a community living in the present, my agenda lifts, my agency returns, and I'm no longer a passive and redundant consumer, but an awakened citizen. Dave DeGraw, who we left on the other side of the Lord's Prayer, explains the dilemma we face as an uninformed populace. Due to the mainstream media, the average person has no understanding of this unprecedented increase in wealth. Imagine if the average American understood that US millionaires now have $50 trillion in wealth. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion. For an estimated $30 billion, you can end world hunger. You can wipe out the entire national debt of the US with just 25% of that wealth. I always thought that classified information and top secret files mostly consisted of data that, if known, would cause people to rise up. Later in the book, Noam Chomsky will explain that to us in detail. We are creatures with an intuitive need for fairness. We are like the monkeys in the cage fed cucumbers while our neighbours scoff grapes. We are in a position to look through the bars and see this injustice and to open the cage door. Dave leaves us with another quote from Jefferson. Enlighten the people generally and tyranny and oppressions of body and mind will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of day. This is similar in intention to the Yogananda quote. Darkness may reign in a cave for thousands of years, but bring in the light and the darkness vanishes as though it had never been. Similarly, no matter what your defects, they are yours no longer when you bring in the light of goodness. Thomas Jefferson, Yogananda, and Dave are all saying the same thing. If people are informed, enlightened, awake, change will come. Well, that's easy enough. We just have to communicate with one another. Having a revolution will be easy. Maintaining the revolution will be where we face challenges. The reason for this cockeyed optimism, which has motored me this far through the book and indeed life, is my certainty that we all want the same thing, but are describing it differently and ascribing the solution to different structures. Some people, like the ISIS insurgents in the Middle East, have an idealized view of Iraq and Syria and likely the world beyond, built upon, I suspect, a militant interpretation of Islam. Donald Rumsfeld and the US military industrial complex have a different ideal that they'd like to impose. Out of sheer bloody diligence, I've extensively researched the meaning of the phrase military industrial complex, and as a result, you are seconds away from knowing what it means and being able to dazzle your pals down the youth club or high society banquet, depending on who the hell you think you are. An informal and changing coalition of groups with vested psychological, moral, and material interests in the continuous development and maintenance of high levels of weaponry, in preservation of colonial markets, and in military strategic conceptions of internal affairs. Remember when that war with Iraq was on your telly? We were told it was absolutely necessary for our personal safety in, I don't know, Ohio or Plumstead, as Saddam Hussein was on the very precipice of developing weapons of mass destruction that would, in the wrong hands, which as far as I can work out means brown hands, ruin our experience of Argos and dancing on ice. 1 million people took to the streets of London in protest under the banner of the Stop the War Coalition because they didn't believe there were any weapons, that Argos and dancing on ice were safe, and it was all an economically motivated, resource-driven trick. It turned out they were right. There were no weapons that could do any serious damage. In fact, when Saddam Hussein was found in a hole he was living in to stay out of trouble, Iraqi resources didn't stretch to full-size Mars bars. He only had little fun-sized ones down there, which to me is the sign of a nation on the brink of implosion. Through the 2020 vision of my retrospeculars, we can now see that the primary beneficiaries of the most recent Middle Eastern conflict that Western nations got properly stuck into were not ordinary people in England, America, or Iraq, but big global companies that are above such quaint notions as nation. Dick Cheney, a man whose name sounds like a prick encased in armour, has strong ties to a company called Halliburton. They made $35 billion from post-war contracts. They do stuff to do with fuel refinery, but have countless subsidiary affiliates, none of which, disappointingly, are Haribo. So nip that rumour in the bud. Loads of British firms made tons from it too. In a way, all this top-level corruption is just a manifestation of a particular aspect of understandable and ordinary human behaviour. Like when I need plumbing done, I might get my mate Mick's cousin to do it. That, I suppose, is a form of cronyism. It would, I suppose, become more problematic if I lied and said next door were using their bathroom to make weapons, then went round and smashed it up, then gave Mick's cousin the job of repairing it and blamed my neighbours for the damage and made them liable. Especially if before the whole fiasco had taken place, a million people had protested outside my house saying it was a blag. This is why people feel disaffected. Everyone knows, not just in their rational minds, but in their guts, our collective folk knowledge that we are being unduly shafted and grifted by the people at the top. Whether it's Cameron and his mates cutting benefits or big financially motivated wars where poor people from this country go and kill poor people from Muslim countries so rich people from both countries can do their thing. We've got more in common with the people we're bombing than the people we're bombing them for. That is why it takes some pretty well-drilled, old-fashioned optimism to get down the polling station on election day. The very system in which we are invited to ritualistically but irrelevantly participate is designed to prevent significant change occurring. The best arguments I've heard for voting since I admitted I don't do it have been to exhibit politeness for dead people. Well, I believe in the glory of God. I believe in the power of people to manifest here on earth a society that represents holy principles. This inoculates me from their bollocks. Find out what the powerful want you to do, then don't do it. What would most terrify the plutocrats and oligarchs that jerk the threads that twitch the flaccid marionettes? An informed, engaged, collectivised, connected, global population with no interest in petty prejudice or tribal illusions sold to divide, whose energy is pragmatically directed at the creation of a justly organised society. I met Alistair Campbell the other day, and he's a lovely bloke who likes football, cares about people, tries to do the right thing, and still justifies that inexcusable war. He told me he liked Tony Blair, but didn't love him. Thought social mobility could be reduced to people describing themselves as middle class, and was proud that less people than ever before describe themselves as working class. Class is a daft system that we have to dismantle, even those of us who glory in glottal stops and hard luck yarns. I've had a bit of a look round the aristocracy recently, and they're not enjoying it. I think they'll be glad when it's over. To proceed, we must accept each other as we are, not where we're from. My mate Johan, who's been doing research for this book, thought I was too nice to Alistair Campbell. He surmised because I was enamoured of his chappish demeanour. There may have been a bit of that, but I also know that as well as being a spin doctor extraordinaire, the power behind the throne, the ball-breaking, hard-talking, journo-smashing inspiration for the thick of its Malcolm Tucker, that he's got mental health issues, and I saw grace in him. This business of seeing divine interconnected beauty in people has been happening more and more lately, and I put it down to meditating too much. Liberated from the materialistic projections of anatomical distinction between humans, who I now see are a refracted projection of one supreme consciousness. As Bill Hicks said, we are one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, there's no such thing as death, life is only a dream, and we are the imagination of ourselves, which ain't bad for a stand-up comedian from Texas. I felt for Campbell because I too have had the odd struggle with the old brain box, and I was fascinated with how he must cope with life after office. "They tire of calm who knew the storm," said Dorothy Parker. I told Campbell that quote, and he went a bit wistful. He's pretty good as one of neoliberalism's foremost propagandists at getting his point across. I said to him, "Alistair, what did you do that war for?" He, remarkably, and with a straight face, tied it into 9/11. You remember, those towers. There were two of them, I think. He said that he and Tony, who has since gone on to become an advisor to a Kazakhstani dictator and a board member of a Middle Eastern oil company, were playing it by ear when the World Trade Center collapsed in a way that some people say looked like a controlled demolition. He said,
We had the same information as anyone else watching it on the TV when it happened, which makes me question the value of international espionage if all these James Bonds and Jason Bournes are getting their info off CFAX. In the intervening period between the 9/11 attacks and the invasion of Iraq, there was accrued considerable information that concluded that the only real link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq was the letter Q. It was an alphabet war, which must be hard to stomach in Arabian countries. They don't even use that alphabet. The rationale for the war was reverse engineered. Legal asterisk. Just so you know, Alistair Campbell didn't bowl into my front room and admit the war in Iraq was an unnecessary contrivance. He was, as usual, world class at managing info. The reverse engineering is my summation and surely that of anyone who isn't either personally responsible for the war or a total div. First, the objective was decided upon, invade Iraq, then the information was compiled that made that course of action plausible. A bit like the homophobes I've mentioned who ransack the Bible for scriptural justification for their odd prejudices, which in truth can only really be strangled homosexual urges. Otherwise, why bother? I'm sure there are other books that will give you a much better account of why the war in Iraq was phony and what the real reasons were. I fucking hope there are. Imagine there wasn't. Imagine this was the most well-researched account of the political and economic motivations for the Iraq conflict available. Imagine that after this book came out, I had to go on news shows with Colin Powell and Jack Straw and sternly talk them through what they'd done while they looked down at their shoes a bit red-eyed and apologised. Then Obama had to have me at the White House and put his hands up and say I'd rumbled them. Then I was flown to Baghdad to meet with leaders of ISIS to explain that there had been a terrible mistake, that they were right to be angry, and that their violence was distinct from that which had preceded it, only in scale. Then they asked if I'd stay and be in charge of a unified Iraq, and I agreed, but Obama said he'd step down and let me run America, so I'd had to do that and all. And then I dissolved the union into a federation of fully autonomous interconnected collectives led by elected local jurors from the community that followed a central edict built on respecting the way of life of others and ecological responsibility, and then shut down Disney and saying it was childish. That would be better than what's happening now, and I've only had a few hours to research these ideas. Imagine what we could do together. Chapter 18. UKIP if you want to, we're awake. Like much of the stuff in this book, the economic ideas, the speculation on global trade treaties, the irregularities of the financial system, there are loads of books that will give you the score on Iraq far more adeptly. I'm not Noam Chomsky, you've probably noticed. I'm happy to be Norman Wisdom. All I'd like to do is dispel the idea that there are no alternative to the systems we are currently using to organise society, and that behind all the myriad corruption and injustice is one all-pervasive idea, and when it's overthrown, we'll all be better off. Noam Chomsky is a linguist, political theorist, a name you'd better start saying at gatherings if you want to be taken seriously. If you're one of the clever, educated people that's reading this book, you'll already know that he's a prominent dissident who has spoken out against US interventionism and the role of propaganda in sedating a population. If you're not clever and educated, you now have a basic understanding and should stop putting yourself down. Chomsky says that at this point in history, alternative visions for society are vital, and those based on cardinal human values of sharing and being ecologically minded deserve serious consideration. The situationists, God love them, were on a quest for authentic life based on these cardinal values. Authentic life with authentic relationships that embrace love, play, participation and creativity. These are universal aspirations that are oddly neglected in our materialistic culture. One way to consolidate and unite the majority of humanity might be to focus on our similarities, not our differences. Sure, the ISIS insurgents right now rampaging through Iraq, somewhat making a mockery of the initial impetus of the West's invasion, may be fuming and Muslim, but beneath their militant goals we will find love. Of course Rumsfeld and Cheney and three generations of mercantile Bushes have got hopelessly entangled in cultural imperialism and greed, but beneath the lust for power is fear, and beneath the fear is love. As surely as the elemental ingredients that make up the temporary event of your face are carbon, hydrogen and oxygen, whether you're an antagonised sunny mercenary or gout-infested neoliberal tyrant, you are unified too by consciousness and love. Consciousness and sentient awareness, which we're expected to believe has inexplicably flowered with no physical, chemical or biological explanation from the peculiarly perfect conditions of our planet. With so much in common, it's extremely primitive to fetishise and flap about difference. In certain anonymous contingent fellowships that help communities of people to live free from addictions to substances and behaviours one day at a time, there is a principle that each group is fully autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or these fellowships as a whole. I think this is a beautiful principle. Any group, tribe, society is free to live by any creed they choose unless their conduct has a negative impact on other communities or our planet. My friend Daniel Pinchbeck, who has spent the last 10 years smashing his brain into a high-functioning mush with ayahuasca, has given us a brief account of what a global utopian vision could look like. We can create a peaceful planetary civilization entirely powered by renewable sources of energy based on cradle-to-cradle practices where everyone on Earth enjoys a high quality of life. Daniel ain't playing. He's gone in hard there with an ecologically responsible, peaceful planetary model. Unless you're some kind of ludicrous hippie, you won't know what the hell cradle or cradle refers to. Well, I do. I looked it up. It's based on the idiom cradle to the grave. By changing the grave bit to cradle, it implies that we have a responsibility beyond our own lifespan. That is, of course, the type of idea that we must adopt. What cradle to cradle means in practice are technologies, products and systems that don't produce waste, and implicit within these systems, as in the phrase itself, is a different attitude to ownership. The example I was given was a pair of cradle to cradle shoes, which sounds like something Jimmy Savile might have worn, but is actually a pair of ecologically responsible trainers. Training shoes where the top part would be reused and the sole recycled, made from biological nutrients. Apparently these things already exist and I bet they're fucking rubbish, which means I'd probably recycle them as soon as I got them and stick my Converse back on. I'm sure the aesthetics will improve and at some point I'm going to have to manage my priorities. Daniel also mentions renewable energy, a subject about which we are being horribly misled. I recently saw a depiction of the area of solar panelling required to provide energy for the entire planet. It was titchy, about the size of Billericay. As usual, the information we get on emergent ideas that can change the world is tightly controlled by people who want the world to stay the same. Food and cigarettes are the best examples of industries where the genie has, after years of stifling, gotten out of the bottle. As I explained earlier, and as you knew anyway, these industries for years gave us information that suited their economic advance and, in conjunction with an ideologically and sometimes financially allied media, concealed information that hampered it. This is why it is vital that we challenge the dominant ideological space. As part of this transition, Daniel says, we can restore and replenish our planetary ecosystems. This shift can happen over the next decades. Daniel acknowledges that ecological reparation is a process that will take decades, but, optimist that he is, believes it is possible. I've spent a fair bit of time with Daniel. He is what you might call a psychedelic shaman. He looks sort of like a live-action Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. Most notably, I spent some time with him in an ashram-type thing in Utah. A temporary commune where free-thinking loonies congregated in yurts to discuss far-out ideas. I went because I've always been fascinated by this stuff. Like most people, I've always sensed there was more to heaven and earth, Horatio, than a dreamt of in your philosophy, as that old misery guts Hamlet said to his pal before ballsing up court life in Elsinore. My clumsy adolescent hallucinogenic experiments unravelled my limited conception of the sensory realm. I met an IVF physician once, and he gave me a cool metaphor for contextualizing knowledge, given additional credence by the fact that he spends his working life jamming recalcitrant spunk cells into dislocated eggs. This empiric knowledge of the micro had awoken him to fathomless tiny continents of impenetrable, invisible wilderness. What is the process that accelerates cellular subdivision? Why do cells stop being indistinct and start to take on particular identities and agencies? He's on the top of his game and has concluded that a convenient shorthand for this potent and purposeful entity is God. The world as we understand it is limited, he explained. Imagine your sensory being as a finger, he began. I often do, so for me it was a doddle. The conscious awareness in the sensorial and experiential world is like a finger in a glass of water. It can experience the parameters and depth of the glass. It can feel the edges. This is how our awareness interacts with the known. To comprehend the unknown, we should imagine putting our finger into the ocean. What a lovely metaphor, easily envisaged and, if necessary, enacted. I might pop down the